Corinthians chapter 9. 1 Corinthians chapter 9. I just want to say that the songs that we've been singing this morning, if we really, and I'm sure we have, sung them with meaning and understanding and with commitment, what Paul's got to say here oughtn't to be a problem for us at all. We should be glad for an opportunity to respond to what Paul says. It starts like this. Am I not free? Am I not an apostle? You'll see the little heading there is Paul's writes as an apostle. He starts off by defending himself as an apostle. And how do we know he's an apostle? Have I not seen Jesus? Are you not the result of my work in the Lord? Even though I may not be an apostle to others, surely to you I am. For you are the seal of my apostleship. The existence of the church at Corinth proved that Paul was an apostle. And this is my defense to those who sit in judgment on me. People were coming in and judging Paul, saying he wasn't an apostle. He has my defense. Don't we have the right to food and drink? Don't we have the right to take a believing wife with us, as do the other apostles and the Lord's brothers and Cephas or Peter? There's the rights of the apostles. They could take, they should be looked after and housed and fed, and they would be able to take their wives with them if they had wives. Or is it only Barnabas and I who don't have the right not to work for a living? Who serves as a soldier? This is like his illustration of the logicalness of apostle having the right to be fed. Who serves as a soldier at his own expense? Or who plants a vineyard and does not eat the grapes? Who tends a flock and does not drink the milk? Do I say this merely on human authority? No. Doesn't the law say the same thing? He's giving now biblical authority for the fact that he ought to be looked after. For it is written in the law of Moses, do not muzzle an ox that is treading out the grain. You don't do that. The ox is entitled to eat as it is treading out the grain. It's the biblical precedent. Is it about oxen that God is concerned? Surely he says this for us, doesn't he? Yes, this was written for us, because when farmers plow and thresh, they should be able to do so in the hope of sharing in the harvest. If we have sown spiritual seed among you, is it too much if we reap material harvest from you? If others have this right of support from you, shouldn't we have it all the more? But we did not use this right. On the contrary, we put up with anything rather than hinder the gospel of Christ. Don't you know that those who serve in the temple get their food from the temple? This is going back to the Old Testament, to the temple service, to the priests. They could eat from the sacrifices, that those in the altar share in what is offered on the altar. In the same way, the Lord has commanded that those who preach the gospel should receive their living from the gospel. Now, I'm not preaching here for an increase or anything like this. But I have not used any of these rites. Oops. That kind of puts a damper on that one, eh? If I was hoping to get something out of this. But I've not used any of these rights. And I'm not writing this in the hope that you will do such things for me. For I would rather die than allow anyone to deprive me of this boast. For when I preach the gospel, I cannot boast, since I am compelled to preach. Woe to me if I do not preach the gospel. If I preach voluntarily, I have received a reward. If not voluntarily, I'm simply discharging the trust committed to me. What then is my reward? Just this, that in preaching the gospel, I may offer it free of charge and so not misuse my rights as a preacher of the gospel. Though I am free and belong to no one, I have made myself a slave to everyone to win as many as possible. To the Jews, I became like a Jew to win the Jews. To those under the law, I became like one under the law, though I myself am not under the law, so as to win those under the law. To those not having the law, I became like one not having the law, though I'm not free from God's law, but I'm under Christ's law, so as to win those not having the law. To the weak, I became weak, to win the weak. I have become all things to all people, so that by all possible means I may save some. I do this for the sake of the gospel, that I may share its blessing. Do you not know that in a race, all the runners run, but only one gets the prize? Run in such a way as to get the prize. Everyone who competes in the games goes into strict training. They do it to get a crown that will not last, but we do it to get a crown that will last forever. Therefore, I do not run like someone running aimlessly. I do not fight like a boxer beating the air. No, I strike a blow to my body and make it my slave, so that after I have preached to others, I myself will not be disqualified from the praise. Well, let's see if we can make some sense out of that. Paul's strategy. I used to think that that strategy, certainly in the church context, was a kind of a new and faddish thing. And so for many years, I really resisted this whole idea of strategizing and this sort of thing. Turns out that long before modern business popularized and taught strategy, strategizing was already happening. Of course, I don't need to mention the brilliant strategists like Alexander the Great or like Hannibal. Their strategies and resulting brilliant victories are legendary. I don't have to mention biblical army generals like David and Gideon. We have on record their brilliant strategies and their brilliant victories. But maybe I do need to mention the Apostle Paul, because you see, Paul wasn't an army general. Paul was a church planter, an evangelist, a strategist. Paul had a clearly articulated strategy. You know what his strategy was? His overarching strategy? He tells us, to the Jews first, then to the Gentiles, Romans chapter 1, verse 16. He puts it out there. And because of that overarching strategy, when he arrived in a town, the first thing he did was go to the synagogue to reason with the Jews. And that's exactly what he did at Corinth. Acts chapter 18 gives us the background to him coming to Corinth, where we read that every Sabbath, Paul reasoned in the synagogue, and Paul devoted himself exclusively to preaching, to testifying to the Jews that Jesus was the Messiah. See, that was his strategy, to the Jews first. And it was only when the Jews refused to hear him that he then focused on the Gentiles. But when the Jews when the Jews opposed Paul and became abusive, he said to them, "From now on, I will go to the Gentiles." Then Paul left the synagogue, went next door to the house of Titius Justus, a worshiper of God. Paul regarded strategy as important, which he then highlights in greater detail in verses 25 to 27, where he speaks about the boxer and he speaks about the runner. Remember all those years ago, Bruce Fordyce. Remember him? Of course you do. If you have anything to do with Comrades Running, if you live in Durban, you're going to know about Bruce Fordyce. He won the Comrade Marathon how many times? How many times on the trot? No, eight on the trot. Consecutive times. And then it was, they called him Force Nodas, Bruce Nodas, when he didn't win the ninth one, but then he won it after that again. Anyway, that's just an interesting aside for you. Bruce didn't train like mad, rock up and run like mad, and win. Bruce had a strategy. He trained and he measured himself. There's this long hill somewhere in Johannesburg, long and steep, and Bruce Fordyce used to measure himself on that hill. And when he could go up that hill in a certain time, then he knew he was ready for Comrades. His strategy to win Comrades began even before he ran the race. But then in the race itself, he didn't just rock up and run like mad. One year, about halfway through the race, one of the other favorites had quite a good margin on Bruce, and he didn't panic. He just kept on running. And afterwards, he was interviewed, and he was asked, "Weren't you worried about that guy ahead of you?" And Bruce says, "Not at all." You see, his strategy was this. He said, "I knew that if I ran a certain pace, anybody who was running faster than that pace was going to blow." And this guy did. And Bruce came through and he won again. Bruce didn't just win because he got lucky. Okay, he had prodigious talent. I give that to him. But talent alone wasn't enough. He raced with a strategy and he won 9 times. Paul speaks about running. He speaks about boxing. And he uses them to illustrate the importance of strategy. And strategy also applies to the Lord's work. What is it that the Lord wants us to do? And then we strategize about how to go about accomplishing what the Lord wants us to do. And we read Acts chapter 18 and we get the background to Paul's time at Corinth, what he did when he got there. Paul wants to plant a church in the strategic city, but how on earth is he going to go about evangelizing it? Well, he's got a strategy. He follows his strategy. He goes in, he starts with the Jews, and then he moves to the Gentiles. But that's a problem, because in Corinth, it was a veritable melting pot of different nationalities. There were Greeks and there were Romans and Phoenicians and Jews and ex-soldiers and philosophers and merchants and slaves and freemen and sailors and traders. This hodgepodge of people. How's he going to do that? Well, he's got a plan. But before we get onto his plan, here's another piece of information that you need to know about Corinth. At Corinth, the philosophers and the orators came and they earned a good living in Corinth. The orator or the philosopher would come in and they would woo the crowds with their beautiful oratory. But they needed a benefactor. And so they would find somebody who was willing to support them, and then they go out being paid by the benefactor. They would go and woo the crowds. Of course, the benefactor wanted some kind of payback. And so one never knew whether the orator was saying what was true for them or whether saying what the benefactor wanted them to say. And this knowledge, this background knowledge, influenced Paul's strategy in Corinth. Look, he goes to Corinth and he starts by establishing his authority to preach the gospel. Am I not an apostle? He asks. You see, along with these orators and philosophers who came to town were those claiming to be apostles. And they were preaching something different from what Paul preached. And these so-called apostles came in and they mocked Paul. They said that Paul had neither physical stature nor oratory abilities. How could he be an apostle? Well, Paul lists a couple of evidences of his apostleship, like he himself had seen Jesus, like the church at Corinth was proof of his apostleship. And he says, even if others don't recognize my apostleship, you, the church I established, surely you recognize me? Am I not an apostle, he says. Having established the genuineness of his apostleship, Paul then says that we as apostles do have certain rights. There were rights that were due to him. For example, the right to bring along a believing wife. Of course, Paul didn't have a wife, but the others brought along a believing wife, and it was the right of an apostle to do so. There was the right to be supported by the church in terms of food and drink. I mean, says Paul, it's logical. If soldiers don't serve in the army at their own expense, why should I or any apostle have to come and work for our own living as a soldier of Jesus in the church? These were some of Paul's rights as an apostle. But what has this got to do with strategy? Well, everything, as it turns out. You see, Paul had the rights of an apostle, but he also had a strategy. And this was his strategy. Listen for it. But I did not use my right. This was his strategy, but I have not used any of these rights. It was his strategy. In fact, Paul did allow other churches to support him. While at Corinth, the Philippian Christians actually sent him some money. But his strategy while at Corinth was no support. Why? Because at Corinth, the accusation could be leveled against him that all he was doing was forwarding the agenda of the benefactor. And that would have hindered the spread of the gospel. So we did not use this right. On the contrary, we put up with anything rather than hinder the gospel of Christ. Strategically, Paul gave up his right to support. He didn't give up his right to support at all churches, but at Corinth he did. That's what implementing his strategic decision to give up his rights look like at Corinth? I'm giving up my rights. And in Corinth, it looks like this. I'm not going to be supported by you. Now, giving up our rights is not a popular strategy. Even for the sake of the gospel, we would struggle to give up our rights. And yet, if Paul were going to emulate the strategy of Jesus, when Jesus came to earth, what else could Paul do? He had to do what Jesus did. This was Jesus' strategy. Though he was God, he did not demand or cling to his rights as God. He made himself nothing. He took the humble position of a slave and appeared in human form. See, Jesus, in order to be effective, gave up his rights. Paul, in order to be effective, gave up his rights. And so, after prayer and consideration, these were strategic decisions that Paul made. First Jews and then the Gentiles. And Acts 18 confirmed that that's what he did. And for the sake of the gospel, I'm willing to give up my rights. That became Paul's modus operandi. And his approach to church planting in Corinth, he lived it out. Paul gave up the right to that to which he was entitled. What the Logos says is actually true. We are saved to serve. And as I was thinking about these things, I wondered how many of us would still be willing to sign up for church membership if we added a clause that said, I am willing to give up my rights for the sake of the gospel as a member of this church. Which, of course, raises the questions. What rights are we clinging to, which is hindering the spread of the gospel? What rights are we clinging to, which is hindering the spread of the gospel? The right to our time, maybe? Oh, I couldn't possibly do that. I don't have time. I've got so many other things to do. My right. The right to our money, maybe? Oh, I couldn't possibly increase my giving. I mean, all my expenses, you just don't know. And I've got a right. Would it impact on our ability to serve our community by presenting Christ in a relevant and authentic way if we, with Christ and with Paul, were willing to make the strategic decision to surrender our rights for the sake of the gospel? And what would that look like for us if we surrendered our rights? Christ surrendered his rights as a son of God. Paul surrendered his rights as an apostle. It had practical implications for Jesus, and it had practical implications for Paul. But Paul has got to evangelize this place, and so him giving up his rights didn't end there, not with Corinth's diverse population. And so he takes it a step further, and he says, though I am free and belong to no one, and we are free, and we are free to do what we want with our lives, we are free to do what we want with our time, we are free to do what we want with our money, we are free to do what we want with our future. Paul notes that. He and we are free, he says. But strategically, he has made a decision to give up his rights. Therefore, he carries on, though I am free and belong to no one, I have made myself a slave to everyone. He has chosen to give up his freedom. It's the outworking of his strategic decision to give up his rights. It's part of Paul's commitment to the gospel. It's part of Paul's strategy, his strategy to win as many as possible. He's willing to do that. You see, Paul's mission in life was to tell people about Jesus. And to be effective in doing this, Paul made the strategic decision to give up his rights, including his rights as an apostle. At Corinth, this meant practically that Paul would have to earn his own living. He had the trade of a tent maker. And so while he was preaching the gospel, he was busy making tents. And then at 12 o'clock in Corinth, when they went on to siesta time from 12 o'clock to 4, well, Paul also downed his tools, but he didn't go and have a siesta. He kept others out of the siesta by preaching the gospel to them, you see. And then at 4 o'clock, he'd pick up his tools again, and he would carry on working. He gave up his rights, and that's what it looked like for him. It was his strategy. But there needed to be more. Remember this diverse population of Corinth? And so we see another implication of his strategic decision to give up his rights. To the Jews, I became like a Jew to win the Jews. See, living in Corinth were Jews. How on earth would Paul now reach those Jews? After all, he was now a Christian. He was living free from legalism. And so in order to win the Jews, Paul was willing to give up his right to live in that freedom and to live again under Jewish legalism. For the sake of the gospel, Paul was willing to embrace a legalistic lifestyle. How else could he engage with the Jews in a way that they understood? Further, to those under the law, I became like one under the law, although I myself am not under the law, so as to win those under the law. Paul is still speaking about the Jews among whom he was working, those who were still under the law, those who still believed they needed to obey the law in order to be acceptable to God. Paul was free. He knew that Christ had paid for him. He wasn't free from the precepts of the law, but he was free from legalism. He did not need to obey the law in order to earn salvation, but for the sake of his witness among the Jews, Paul was willing to give up that freedom and live as one still under the law. Further, to those not having the law, I became like one not having the law, although I'm not free from God's law, but I am at Christ's law, so as to win those not having the law. Yeah, Paul is obviously referring to non-Jews. He's referring to Gentiles. He's referring to those without an Old Testament background, without any understanding of Yahweh God. He's talking about those. Today, we might refer to those who are unchurched, those who have no biblical background. How did Paul give up his freedom to win them? He tells us, I became like one not having the law. He hastens to add that does not mean that he was now free to embrace an immoral lifestyle because he's still subject to Christ's law. But in our context, it would mean something like this. We identify with the culture of those we are trying to win for Christ. Are we comfortable with that culture? Probably not. So putting ourselves into that culture will mean taking ourselves out of our comfort zone in order to identify with a culture different from our own. And that's why I'm so glad Hilton said what he did with the expression on his face, you know, that long hair. It's okay, you know. Maybe we're not comfortable with that. But if that is the culture in which we are living and working, we learn to accept it. I know that's not what you meant, Hilton, so I'm just thank you for giving me this opportunity. But that's what we do. We embrace things which we are personally not comfortable with. Paul had made the strategic decision to give up his rights. So for the sake of the gospel, Paul was willing to live with things he personally would not have chosen. Do you get that? He was willing to live with things he personally would not have chosen. He gave up his right. He deals with one more group. To the weak I became weak in order to win the weak. And Paul here is referring to those with a weak conscience. Imagine you're discipling someone who comes from a family background of alcoholism. Now, you feel comfortable with having a beer after your bike ride, or maybe to drown your sorrows after the rugby match yesterday. You are comfortable with a glass of wine with your meal. You are free to do that. Strategically, you are willing to give up that freedom. And so you choose not to have a drink for the sake of their weak conscience for the sake of the gospel. You see, that's what it means when you give up your rights for the sake of the weak. Paul, he's made a strategic decision, and it had practical implications for him. It will for us too, but Paul had a burning desire. He wanted to share the gospel with a cosmopolitan society, and to accomplish that meant a willingness to give up his rights, a willingness to give up his freedoms. Paul's strategy served his mission. I want you to understand that his strategy served his mission to win as many as possible, his mission to win those under the law, his mission to win those not having the law, his mission to win the weak. He wanted to win people for Jesus. That was his mission. And after going through all that, Paul comes to his summary statement. Paul wants to try and encapsulate what he has said about his strategy in one sentence. Understand the context. It's a summary statement. He's trying to encapsulate everything he said in one sentence. And he does that in verse 22. Are you ready for that one sentence? Etap. I have become all things to all people, so that by all possible means I might save some. His strategy was to serve his mission. And so we have ATTAP, shortened to @TAP. ATAP. It's a summary statement. ATAP, it's a strategy. ATAP, it's not a standalone strategy. ATAP assumes all Paul has said. ATAP assumes a willingness to give up our rights to accomplish what we as a church have agreed. We have agreed that the Lord wants us to serve our community by presenting Christ in a relevant and authentic way. This means that ATAP is not just a catchy phrase, although it might also be that. ATAP summarizes a commitment we as a church make to let go of our rights, to let go of our freedoms, because we are about an issue which is far, far bigger than what I would prefer. The issue is far bigger. ATAP is a commitment to become all things to all people, so that by all possible means we might save some. Then you know what saddens me? As I thought about this while I was preparing, it devastated me that some of us here are going to brush this off as a punt for a name change. Some of us will do that. And by doing that, we're going to sidestep the real issue. You see, here's the real challenge what Paul is sharing with us. To what extent am I willing to give up my rights, my freedoms? To what extent am I willing to give up my rights, my freedoms, for the sake of serving our community by presenting Christ in a relevant and authentic way? That's the issue. And if the songs that we sang before mean anything to us, it shouldn't be an issue. And I'd like to take a moment just for us to consider that, shall we? Let's just have a moment to consider it. Heavenly Father, as we consider these things, we don't want to think of them in terms of what we're going to have to give up. Lord, let us consider them in terms of what we will gain. In fact, what we have already gained. We've already gained intimacy with the Father. We've already gained a meaningful life. We've already gained the promise of an eternity with you. We've already gained the fact that you will never leave us nor forsake us. We've already gained so much. And Lord, to the extent that we enter into this, to that extent we have a greater and greater experience of all that you have come to give us. You've come and you've said that I've come that you might have life, more and better life than you ever dreamed possible. Lord, it's what we're going to gain. It's not about what we're going to give up. You gave up heaven so that we could gain heaven. You've done the giving up. We don't have to. We live in grace. Lord, let us think in terms of what we gain. And what ultimately we'll gain is when we walk into your presence and hear you say to us, "Well done, good and faithful servant. Enter into the joy of your salvation." Oh Lord, those who have this hope, help us to purify ourselves now, just as you are pure. In Jesus' name, amen.